Sam, keeping it true, watching old movies so you don't have to. With the benefit of hindsight, we'll see where the movies truly are for, or did it change history? Good evening. And welcome back to the Benefit of Hindsight podcast, the movie podcast in which a father and son talk about movies that they watched together long ago.
We give each movie a memory score and then rewatch the movie to see whether or not it's better or worse than we remember. And then we score the movie again.
With me, as ever, is my son, Sam. Good evening, Sam.
Good evening, Dad. How are you doing?
I'm going to go with, you know, when we do one word review, I'm going to do one word answer to your question.
Okay.
Tired.
Yeah, that was the same word as me.
It was, there were variations on the theme. Tired, sleepy. I was going to go with a knackered, but I thought tired would be more polite. So, tired.
I was going to say exhausted, but I'm not actually that. No, I don't think that's accurate.
Synonyms for tired: knackered, exhausted, sleepy,
Sam.
Wasted, Sam, Dean. It's all happening. Anyway. Surely, in what has been an interesting week for both of us, there must be an anecdote of some sort.
I thought about one. There was one that happened to me this morning, but I think, I don't know if I want to share that with the world, so I'm not going to. A different time this morning, though, I woke up at 3 o'clock in the morning and heard a cat cry outside, like a meow of sorts. Like, quite a lot, actually. And I was... I like cats, so I was curious what was going on, and then I saw one sort of flailing about. So I went out, put some trousers on, 3 o'clock in the morning.
Good shout.
And then went to go and figure out what was going on with this cat. I did see a cat. It walked away. Nothing happened. But why did I put trousers on and not shoes?
Well, I mean, there are many possible answers to that question. And how was the cat? I mean...
I don't actually know. All I saw was a shadow of a cat and its eyes glowing in the dark. I tried to get it to come over, but it just sort of wandered off. It wasn't even scared, it just left. So I don't know what was actually going on.
It's because you weren't wearing shoes. I thought you were
probably
a weirdo.
Yeah.
It's like, who's that fella without shoes on? Don't go anywhere near him. That's what it was thinking.
Exactly, yeah. It's so quiet at 3 o'clock in the morning. I mean, obviously, it's weird.
Apart from the cats, obviously.
Ah, true.
Yeah. Well, anyway, Sam and I have gone with a change from our usual format, for this is our end of season two, climax, season ender, and instead of watching a movie that we saw together in the cinema, we decided that we would do our Flash Gordon special episode. Now, this is based on a listener question that we had some time ago, which was, if you had $200 million to spend on a movie, which one would you remake? And I very forcefully said Flash Gordon and subsequently insisted that we watch it together. So, Sam, you gave this a foresight, not hindsight movie, and you gave it a foresight score of?
8 out of 10.
And I gave it a hindsight score of 10 out of 10 because it is, by a significant degree, the best movie ever made of all time ever. and so we're going to crack straight on with this. We won't do the listener question because we want to come back with that at the beginning of season three. So after this, there'll be a short break. But we're going to go on with Flash. So you gave it a foresight score of 8. Am I right in thinking you've never seen this movie before until now?
So... And now that I have seen the movie, I can confirm I have never watched it in one sitting. I may have seen bits and pieces here and there, but I never knew the story or anything about it. So yes, this is probably the first time I've ever seen Flash Gordon.
And do you think your foresight score will change?
Yes.
Oh, that sounds ominous. Do I think my hindsight score will change? Yeah, probably. But let's see how it goes with this conversation. And then at the end of this episode, once we've done the whole normal Benefit of Hindsight chat, we'll then talk about how we might recast it. So there'll be an extended episode for our listener out there.
Extended in concept, maybe not time.
Yeah, depends on how much we have to say about Flash Gordon. So let's begin where we always begin, with the cast. So... the cast of Flash Gordon, Sam Jones, famously as Flash. What did you make of Sam Jones as Flash.
I really liked him. I know it's not his voice. We'll get that out of the way pretty quickly. But I would have liked to have seen the original version with his voice. But I don't know. This plays into who I would cast later on. But he has this sort of weird... He's obviously an adult, but he has this boyish charm to him. And his facial expressions is just... It works in the sense of wonder and excitement, and he totally gets it. Just slight sidetrack. In my head, going into this movie, Flash Gordon was already a superhero, and that was the concept of Flash Gordon. I had no idea that he was a football player, American football.
Okay.
But yeah, quarterback. That's a slight sidetrack. But I did think he was great in the role, and I would have liked to have seen or heard what his vocal interpretation of it would have been. Apparently not good enough.
I think it's important when you do this movie to kind of not go along with all of the cult hype that exists with this movie. So if you just take this movie as it is and you look at the cast, it's a pretty strong cast, right?
It is, yeah. Brian Blessed.
Brian Blessed, Max von Sydow, Topol, Timothy Dalton, Peter Wingard, and even like the kind of female leads, Melody Anderson and Ornella Muti. Ornella Muti was a very, very famous Italian actress at the time that this was made. Mm-hmm. And so this is a pretty strong cast. And Max von Sydow, if that's how you say his name, as Ming, was just, you know, how did they get him?
I wouldn't know any of this background, because I think for the most part, this is the first time I've seen any of them, apart from maybe like Timothy Dalton, Brian Blessed, that sort of thing. So I didn't know any of that.
So yeah, I mean, Max von Sydow, I don't know how you say it, but he had been a movie star since the 1960s, and he's got a really long filmography both before and after this movie. Most famously, actually, in the 1960s, he played Jesus in a film. He was in a film in which he played, well, the titular character, Jesus. So, you know, they've all been around a bit. But I think you're right to say that Flash Gordon carries the whole movie, regardless of the fact that it's not his voice.
Yeah. To be honest with you, though, as well, I would give a lot of credit to the character of Dale Arden carrying a lot of the movie as well. I didn't see coming as well.
Yeah, she's pretty good. And obviously, Brian Blessed, Timothy Dalton is very good. There's a couple of really nice cameos in there as well, which most people now know because of the cult status of this movie. Did you see Robbie Coltrane in it?
I didn't. But then when I was going through the trivia, that's one that I came across. Now I kind of want to go back and see it. Yeah, quite cool.
He's literally in it for about 10 seconds. He plays Man at Airplane. Topol, who plays Hans Zarkov, was famously the lead part in Fiddler on the Roof, the movie. You know, this is a decent cast of actors in this 1980 science fiction classic movie.
Yeah, cool.
It does kind of lead to the question, which we would normally cover, is how well they performed in the service of the script and how well the script serviced them. Do you have a particular view on that?
I think if you go into this movie knowing it's going to be a campy 80s film set based on like an old comic book, then they pull it off quite well and the script marries it quite well and it all works. But I feel like going back into it in the 80s, it would have been a huge disappointment. It's probably like the equivalent of the Fantastic film. Not really going against the source material and just being a terrible script in hindsight.
Yeah, I mean, listen, it is very easy to pick holes in the script. It does have some of... I think, is it the worst dialogue? Flash, I love you, but we only have 14 hours to save the Earth. Flash.
But I think it works in a sort of cheesy way.
It kind of does. And another thing to get out of the way early on is, does this movie fall into the category of so bad it's good?
That would give my score away.
Okay, we'll come back to that question. I also think that, hey, I know an interesting fact about this movie. Can we get it in before we do the your trivia? And I hope I haven't stolen it.
Go for it, yeah.
So George Lucas wanted to remake Flash Gordon. And he tried and tried and tried and couldn't get the rights. So eventually decided, oh, I'll just write my own.
Yeah.
And he wrote Star Wars.
That's quite
cool.
And
the rest, as they say, is history. Yeah.
I don't know. I feel like I prefer that version of history. Because obviously I like Star Wars. But I would have loved to see his interpretation of Flash Gordon. Absolutely. Who wouldn't?
Well, who wouldn't? And it's possible that it wouldn't have worked, you know. I think that what you finally get is this great camp, colourful festival of nothing that I think could only have come out of the late 70s, early 80s. I wonder if a mid-70s version with George Lucas at the helm would have been anywhere near as awfully brilliant as this.
Yeah, it makes me wonder, though, if George Lucas just had a hidden ability to make a franchise out of something, would we have gotten a huge franchise to this day, continued of the Flash Gordon universe, instead of Star Wars? And it was sort of like, it's a parallel universe, where Star Wars didn't quite make it.
I do think somewhere there's a multiverse in which Ewan McGregor has been recast. Yeah. As the young Baron or the young Ming or something like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it would have been really interesting. And like all of these things, you know, history deals things and people a certain hand. But there would have been, I think, something really interesting to see a mid-1970s version of this movie by George Lucas.
Yeah, I'd pay for it.
Is there, as far as cast goes, if you had to single out a member of the cast that was... the best, who would you go with
other than Flash Gordon himself?
Obviously other than, yeah. Sam J. Jones.
I don't know, I think Timothy Dalton did quite well, but that's only because I haven't really seen him in a role like that, so to me it was different.
I think Timothy Dalton, I think he's great in this. At the time, he's obviously this fairly well-respected Shakespearean,
yeah,
British actor who would later go on to be James Bond and, you know, carve out a kind of movie star career for himself. But at the time, I think he was considered this kind of Shakespearean actor, very British, and he's great. I love, absolutely love just how much he invests into his role.
Yeah.
At no point is there any sense that he's not taken it seriously. He delivers every line as if it was written by William Shakespeare. And he's just great in it. I love the fact that he takes it so seriously.
That's one of those, I can't think of it, like any of the good examples that we've had where it's just a random actor in a completely pointless film, but they give it their all and it works. And I appreciate that from Timothy, yeah.
I think Jeremy Irons and Aragon.
Yeah, that's the one, yeah.
for which you famously said you want to watch the film that Jeremy Irons thought he was in. Yeah. I want to watch the film that Timothy Dalton thought he was in. Obviously, Brian Blessed shouting his way through the whole thing is just awesome.
It's just a given for Brian Blessed. That's all I ever see him do.
And the recently late Peter Wingard as Clytus talking through his mask... is also very good. Yeah. I remembered a thing from the kind of time that I was watching this originally. I don't think I saw it when it first came out when I was very young, but I certainly saw it as a teenager, maybe sort of 12 or 13. And I do remember even at that point, and this is a bit of a confession, I have to say, being slightly confused as a young teenage boy by Aura, played by the Italian actress Ornella Muti.
Yeah.
I found her quite, what's the word I'm looking for here as I make my confession? Confusing as a young teenager.
You might have to elaborate on that, if you can.
Well, she's actually a pretty well-known and respected Italian actress. She's made some decent Italian films. But for what is essentially a movie that you suspect is made for children and their parents,
yeah,
she doesn't hold back on the whole sensual thing, does she?
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah.
Almost to the point of it being mildly uncomfortable at times?
Yeah, I mean, there's the scene in the spaceship, for me, didn't quite feel right. It didn't feel like it was in the right place at the right time and totally could have been left out or not quite as played as that much. I'm trying to dance around the problem here, but you know what I mean, I hope.
I do, and there were all these kind of adult themes, these sort of Greek tragedy themes that came out. So there's the bit where Ming the Merciless, in a very early scene, does that thing with his ring, if you'll pardon the impression, or the expression rather, where he makes... Dale Arden do a little dance, yeah, under the terrible special effects. And Ming says, did you ever see such a response? And Clytus says, no, she even rivals your daughter. Oh, where's all that coming from?
That was icky. Yeah.
It's just weird. And she seems to be doing it with everybody. So I found her mildly confusing as a teenager. Because, you know, I'm trying to watch this action movie and there's this fairly young, attractive woman who is clearly far too sensual. She thinks she's in a different movie, basically.
That sounds like me trying to explain how I'm enjoying Transformers 2 for the giant robots, not the women, when I was a kid.
Exactly.
Which was true. It's just, you feel like you have to kind of defend it.
That's exactly right. Yeah, you're like, you know, I don't know what you mean. I've seen Megan Fox, but I'm really just enjoying Shia LaBeouf's performance with the big robots.
Just to kind of flip it onto the other side, it really bothered me that when Flash Gordon's in, like, he's tied up, he's got his hands above him, and Dale Arden comes in and touches his sweaty, hairy chest and then his lips. Like, that's gross. Don't do that.
Yeah. I know. It's so 80s. It's so camp. It's so 80s. It is like, you know, if you had to encapsulate the very early 1980s, this movie came out in 1980, in a single movie, this would be it. You know, the fact that, you know, the big blonde hair, the slightly hairy chest, the tight leather shorts. I mean, for heaven's sake.
I think it's the pinnacle of the 80s, of everything 80s, yeah. That I know of, and anyway. Yeah, I wasn't there.
But it might be, except it came in 1980. So maybe it's really, maybe it's that kind of crossroads between the late 70s and the early 80s. Maybe it's the point where the 70s realized it couldn't go any further. And then you started to get different things.
True.
What about the kind of look of the film, the direction of the movie? What did you make of all of that kind of stuff?
I think the look of it, in terms of like set design and sort of not necessarily CGI, but the location of space, like, is it space? I'm not entirely sure, but you know what, like the sky sort of thing. I think that works in such a clever, colorful, comic booky way that you sort of buy into it feeling like that. And it's not gritty and dark and futuristic. It makes sense along with the movie. If it was the same exact movie, but everything was a dark brick building, wouldn't work. Yeah. It's like saying if it was a serious tone and everything was bright coloured, that also wouldn't work. So I think it works well and it pairs quite well with it. And again, bit spoiler later on, but I wouldn't change anything about it.
No, I wouldn't either. I think it's got a really good colour palette. And actually, I think it's a colour palette that has inspired some other filmmakers later on. I mean, you know, again, this might be another thing that comes up, but you can see clear, maybe I'm wrong, but you can see clear parallels between this and the most recent Thor movie, for example.
True. Yeah.
And even a little bit of Guardians of the Galaxy as well. There's definitely some kind of inspiration for how this movie looks into those things, where you get this incredibly rich color palette. And you're right. If you apply the Cavill scale to the special effects in this movie, you're probably going to end up somewhere on the minus of that. But actually, you're right. It absolutely works in its own context.
I don't know if this is entirely true, but let's pretend it is. When Kevin Feige sits people down to make a new Marvel movie, he always shows them, I think it's the original Superman film, and maybe another one, I can't quite remember. But it'd be really funny if Flash Gordon was the secret movie that everyone had to sit and watch to study before they made their own film. That would be cool.
I think it probably should be, right? Yeah. If you're gonna make a superhero movie, why would you make anything that isn't in some way this?
I mean, you could spin it in both ways. Watch this movie, this is what you shouldn't do. Watch this movie, this is what you should do. And it works.
Yeah. Well, I think anybody out there who was interested in making that kind of movie should definitely watch it, because it wasn't a great success at the time. But 45 years later, an astonishing 45 years later, people still talk about it.
Yeah.
Probably thanks to Ted.
Oh, I didn't know that. Is there a link?
Yeah, do you not know that?
No, I've never seen Ted. I've been told to, but I've never seen it.
It was very, there's a famous scene in Ted where they go to a party and Sam Jones is there.
Oh, okay.
So they're in awe of Sam Jones, and as he walks towards them, the kind of Flash Gordon theme tune starts playing.
Nice.
And it's this kind of homage to the movie with Sam Jones. There's also a really good documentary called Life After Flash, in which the people who were in the movie then go on to talk about the movie itself. It does have this, let's be honest, fairly cult following, I have to say.
I remember today, actually, that in the CW Flash show, as soon as he goes to run into a black hole and do that dramatic thing, they play the Flash song. It's like always saving it for the perfect moment. I remember that today, weirdly enough, yeah.
Yeah, and the movie as well, of course. I mean, I remember watching Flash Gordon as a much younger child. So there was this thing that definitely doesn't exist anymore, but was Saturday morning cinema.
Yeah.
So you could pay a pound and you would go to the cinema and you would watch. There would be a short movie, a cartoon, there'd be a raffle, then there'd be an old black and white thing, then be like this 45-minute movie made just for cinema. And that was a thing that existed in my childhood between the hours of 9 and midday, sort of parents pack you off there while they go and do the shopping and things. And the old Flash Gordon, the 1930s and 40s Flash Gordon, frequently played in that. And that would be the late 1970s. And so if the original Flash Gordon series is from the late, like 1930s, 1940s. So the thing that struck me after that long preamble was we are further away from this version of Flash Gordon than I was then to the 1935 version that was in black and white.
Wow. That's kind of cool. It's a little bit scary, but yeah.
Right, so this is pre the Second World War Flash Gordon, and I was closer to it then than I am to this version of the movie now.
Wow.
And there you go. We should get on to the things we always talk about, and I don't know if I'm putting this off. I'm somewhat reluctant to get into it, but what did you make of the soundtrack?
It sounded very familiar.
There are parts of it where you think, I may have heard that before.
It's actually because of the Doctor Who film we made years ago. You took the music from it.
Yes.
Yeah. I finally got to hear it in reality. But no, I did enjoy the music, both sort of score and soundtrack. And I'm going to be honest, you can't replace Queen. It's perfect for it. I love that they made it and like worked on it.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't change it, which is again just a bit of a spoiler.
You have this. There's a couple of things. Obviously, it's Queen, and obviously, I'm quite well known for being. I've heard of them, but I love this idea of these kind of serious musicians. Whatever you think of Queen, however you rate them, whatever. But they're these serious musicians sat in a recording studio watching the kind of daily rushes that are coming back. Yeah. And they're sat there just thinking, okay, we've got this idea. We'll compose this. There's Freddie Mercury, the great composer who wrote Bohemian Rhapsody, who wrote Killer Queen, just playing around on a keyboard and all this silliness that comes out. And it's just, I love that. I just think there's something awesome about it. And I wonder the extent to which the soundtrack is part of the reason why this film went on to have the status that it carries now.
Yeah, I'm not sure that without Queen it would have landed and still been quite as popular. I feel like it could have been lost to the ethos of different movies back then. But because
Absolutely.
Queen made it stick out and stand out perfectly, I think it works. And people still, yeah.
But you're right, the score by Howard Blake is also very, very good. There is a really good classical score in this. Do you know what other movie Howard Blake is most famous for?
Oh, please tell me it's something deadly serious.
He is the guy that is the composer of the Snowman music, Walking in the Air.
Wow. That's cool.
So on that song, on Walking in the Air and in the Snowman, he famously worked with David Bowie. And on this, he famously worked with Queen. But I think the way those two scores and soundtrack work together is just fantastic. It's a really good soundtrack.
Yeah, I think that shows range.
It certainly does. Is it the best soundtrack of all time ever?
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, obviously. But But I also think, I think the thing that's worth saying about the soundtrack is it probably was the first proper rock soundtrack. So there had been soundtracks before. So you get things like Tommy by The Who, and you get movies about music for which people have contributed a soundtrack. But I think they were probably the first rock band to do a soundtrack for a movie that was not a movie about music, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that does make sense. That's cool.
And it does feel quite random.
Yeah, I suppose it probably does, yeah.
Because history, I suppose, is now different. So we're talking about the movie that's 45 years old. We're talking about a rock band that has existed for over 50 years. But at the time, Queen were just another band. They'd been around for about 7 or 8 years, which is unfathomable for us to think of. That none of the Radio Gaga or Live Aid or any of that stuff had happened. They were just contacted and said, do you want to do a soundtrack? And they said yes. And it just seems really random to me that that's what happened.
Yeah, I never really thought about it like that, but that is random, yeah.
But I mean, the Flash's theme, what a great song.
Oh yeah, you can't top that as a theme song. I think this probably borderlines on Out of Pocket Take, but I like to think that in this universe where it all happened, Queen actually made the song as Flash's gift for saving the world.
That is exactly what happened. Yeah, so you get this kind of soundtrack where it's basically Queen saying thank you. Thank you, yeah. Flash. You know the bit at the end where it says thanks, Flash. That is from Queen. And that's nice. That's what's happening there. Hey, would you like to know how much money it made at the box office?
It actually made so much money that it caused a recession.
It did. It made so much money. No, it cost approximately $20 to $27 million to make, which is, I suppose, quite a lot of money 45 years ago. And it made a total of $46.5 million. So it made a bit of money, but it didn't, to be fair, make a great deal of money. And but it does now have an 83% approval rating on Rotten Tomatoes.
Wow, that's good.
Yeah. When it came out, it was not well reviewed. Let's just say that.
Yeah, I can imagine. I think some of the reviews that I caught sight of, because I don't like to look when I have my own, nowadays we're praising it though, so it's all good.
Yeah. It is now. It says on the notes that I have here, it's a favorite movie of Edgar Wright and Taika Waititi.
That makes so much sense.
None of which surprises me. But do you know which famous person said that she watched it with her family every Christmas?
Winona Ryder.
It's such a good guess, but it isn't.
Oh, okay.
So apparently, this is a story told by Brian Blessed, and it must therefore be true.
Everything he says is true.
He met Queen Elizabeth II.
Oh.
And she said, oh, it's you. You're in one of my favourite films. I watch it with my grandchildren every Christmas.
Wow. That's cool. So
there you go. Apparently Queen Elizabeth II was a fan. Obviously Seth MacFarlane is a fan. Yeah. And it just keeps going. There's just all of these people that say, you know, this is just one of the best movies ever made. Stan Lee is on record as saying that it was inspirational to him in some of the work that he was doing. And all of these people just go on and talk about it. And I think it's probably one of the most, I would say it's one of the most quoted movies of all time. I don't think that's true, but it has, I think, the most quotable line of all time.
Is that Gordon's alive?
Exactly that, yeah. And also, it also has the line, who wants to live forever in it?
Yeah, I like that. There's a cool nod, yeah.
Is that there's probably, because there is, of course, a famous Queen song called Who Wants to Live Forever.
Did that come before or after, sorry?
It did come after. But that song, Who Wants to Live Forever, is inspired by the Highlander movie.
So
the second movie for which Queen did the soundtrack, which is also currently being remade by the way.
Yeah, why is that getting a remake?
why is that getting a remake and Flash Gordon isn't? It's got Henry Cavill as the titular Highlander, and they've just cast Karen Gillan in it as well.
Yeah. She doesn't have to do an accent.
That's exactly what she said.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that she said. Yeah, and so that came from there. And I wonder if this sort of seed for that song was planted by that particular line of dialogue.
Yeah, it's cool.
I have to say, back to the soundtrack, kudos to Brian May Brian May famously said, not famously, but Brian May said that about halfway through the project, the rest of the band got really bored. And they're sort of a bit sick of it, and Fred's like, oh, I can't be bothered anymore. And the other two have, you know, sodded off somewhere. And at the same, and so they go off to record an actual Queen album without Brian May. And they leave Brian May in a studio somewhere to finish off the soundtrack to Flash Gordon. And I can't remember where I've read this or heard it, but I think it's almost certainly true. Apparently he was able to finally deliver the finished soundtrack literally like 20 minutes before it was due. It was like he had stayed up for 3 days piecing the whole thing together or something like that. And so I think, you know, whatever you think of this soundtrack, Brian May is, I think, the driving force behind the whole thing. Also, the movie also inadvertently gave us the song Crazy Little Thing Called Love.
Oh, really? I didn't know that either.
Which is a song that Freddie wrote in the bath. And so Freddie wrote the song on the guitar in the bath. And because Brian was somewhere, another part of the world, doing the Flash Gordon soundtrack, when they went in the studio to record it, Freddie played the guitar. And so you got Crazy Little Thing Called Love because of Flash Gordon.
Cool. I'm learning loads today.
I'm sort of going to geek out on this.
That's fine.
There must, I think, of course, however, be many pieces of trivia and or out-of-pocket takes you have on this.
Nothing that can really top what you've said, to be fair. But there you go. Everybody, I think, knows that Flash jumping towards the camera screaming, yeah, one of the best bits, by the way, was improvised by Sam J. Jones. What I didn't know is that it's because nobody could figure out how to end the movie. I don't know how entirely true that is, but I love the idea.
I want it to be true. Well done, Flash, you've saved your Earth. Yeah. Brilliant. I want that to be true, even if it isn't.
Yeah. According to Sam J. Jones as well, while filming the tilt and disc fight scene, which I didn't see coming but really enjoyed, the actors got covered in paint from the disc because it was spray painted silver, so they had to take extra time between takes to clean themselves, which is just a funny bit of trivia.
It's such a pointlessly good scene, though. You know, like when you watch a movie, you think, oh, it could have been 10 minutes shorter if they'd done that, and you know, that bit was a bit unnecessary. If you took out all of the unnecessary stuff from this movie, it would be 7 minutes long.
Probably, yeah.
Like the bit where they wipe his mind, Agent Zarkov, whatever his name is. It's gone completely. Hans Zarkov. They wipe his mind, okay? And it's deeply dramatic. It sort of takes you back through his childhood and through the Holocaust and everything else. And then 10 minutes later, he's like, no, it didn't work.
I just thought of something else.
Brilliant. but at the same time that it didn't work, when they press the little buttons and say let's call up Agent Zarkov, bloop, 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 it did work. He can hear it in his head. So did it work, true, or did it not work? It's very confusing.
I will say, though, I really appreciate the fact that they actually took the time to film all of that of his childhood and everything. Like, they could have easily just phoned it in and made a bad attempt at doing it, but it worked quite well, and I really like that they did that, because nowadays they just wouldn't. I think, again, somehow Transformers 2, when they do that little projection of Sam Witwicky's memories, it's all things that we've already seen in either movie, and that just feels cheap, but in this, filming it, perfect. I like that.
I spotted as the end credits were rolling, to which I obviously watched because there was a music playing, there is actually somebody who gets a directorial credit for that particular sequence.
Ah, cool.
So it had been given to somebody to make that sequence. And they also got that great line, we are going to empty your mind as if we might empty your pockets. okay. She's scary.
Cool.
She is scary.
She is. Yeah. Early in the film, this is a cool bit of trivia, just filmmaking wise, that I liked. Ming is always shot from below, putting him above the audience. But as Flash begins to unite forces, he's shot at level with the audience. And towards the end, he's shot from above, symbolising his defeat. And I just really like subtle camera things like that you can go back and revisit and see. And I thought it was really clever.
It isn't badly directed by Mike Hodges. It's not bad. There's obviously things that were limiting in the late 1970s, early 80s, but it's not badly directed. The actors are acting well. Some of the photography isn't bad, and you're right. There are lots of little things where you think, okay, there's obviously kind of a deeper attempt to tell a story. And actually, one of the things you referenced already, which is the fight on the wobbly thing, that's actually pretty well shot. And the stuff on the moon of Arboria, it's quite nicely shot and things. So there is definitely some decent direction there. And Mike Hodges, you know, he knew what he was doing, I think.
Appreciate that, yeah.
Do you have any controversial opinions on this movie?
Well, I feel like the fan cast thing covers that. I feel like that's as controversial as I can get. So I've kind of dialed back on it. So I haven't got any, because I think that's what it's going to be. Maybe I could say that, was the pillow fight really necessary?
There's so many things in this movie that are unnecessary. Will it make me forget? No, but it won't help you mind remembering. And then Ming torturing his own daughter, and then, you know, bringing Flash Gordon back to life in his underpants and things. It's just, the whole thing is just like, it's hilarious. And there's also some things like, oh, here is the big egg timer thing. You have until the sands run out. And it's upside down. I could never quite figure out if that's on purpose. And if it is on purpose, why? What difference does that make? It's an egg timer. What difference does it make?
Jumping back to a scene we've already mentioned as well, when he's in the spaceship and she teaches him how to use the controls, she immediately uses them differently. I don't know if you saw that.
It's quite funny. There are some major inconsistencies. My favorite inconsistency, I don't know if you remember this or you even noticed it, they're in the rather inappropriately shaped rocket ship, and you've got to keep your foot on that red pedal, which is going to take you all across the universe and the galaxy in about 20 minutes. And you've got Hans Zarkov struggling with, he says, for God's sake, strap yourselves down. And he's really struggling to get the thing over because of the G-forces. Uh-huh. Meanwhile, Dale and Flash are just strapping themselves in. no effort required, basically.
I think it's little bits like that just make it work beautifully.
It is. And why then is when Ming the Merciless is attacking planet Earth with the hot hail and all the earthquakes and everything else, why is he specifically focused on Flash Gordon's aeroplane?
Yeah, that's true.
Why? I also like some of the inappropriate swearing that's in it as well.
Yeah, classic. Mm. That's like the original Transformers cartoon movie. I keep mentioning Transformers today. That's a bit weird.
I think they have things in common, by the way, so I think that's fair enough. I love the bit where Baron runs into the room and he says, freeze you, and we don't swear on our family show podcast, but it basically is completely inappropriate swearing. Freeze you, it's so funny, it's so pointless, it's completely unnecessary. I liked it a lot.
Yeah.
And while we're on this little rant about things that are in there that don't need to be in there, but they are, so let's just enjoy them. The way in which Clitus dies, with his eyes popping out and all of that kind of stuff, pointless. And then when the lady dies, the kind of evil whatever she is, she melts unnecessarily.
It's like a weird inconsistency with it all.
Why is she melting? Also, Brian May does a wedding march on his guitar.
Yeah, that's cool.
Things that are unnecessary, but still quite funny. There we are. Many things.
I do want to say the rest in peace, Lizard Man. He was a real one.
Yeah, he
right at the beginning.
Lizard Man, and then the guy who ends up. You see, there's a thing. There's in a film full of light and color, it does have some really dark moments in it, doesn't it? Like the bit where he says, "Oh, we value your loyalty above all else. Fall upon your sword." What?
Yeah.
And then he kills him anyway. It's just so weird. What a weird, weird movie. I think the controversial opinion about this movie is probably how we're going to score it at the end.
Probably, yeah.
But it is. So should we do that? Should we do the scores? Because we want to get onto the second half of our movie, which is we've been given $200 million and we're going to remake it. So we want to have a conversation about that too. So do you want to crack on with our scores and get into that? So I chose the movie, so I get to go first, and I gave it a 10. There's a big pause there because If I had to be truly objective about this movie, the controversial opinion that I would give is that it's just awful. It's not a great okay. movie. The main character is fine. There's actors who are servicing the script as well as they can. The special effects aren't great, even for 1980. And yet, you watch the whole thing with a smile on your face from ear to ear. It is a wonderful, wonderful thing. And the reason why it has a cult following is for all of the things that we've been talking about. It's just you can sit and rewatch it over and over and over again and probably find something else. Mm-hmm. So I won't surprise you by saying that if I was subjectively scoring this movie as an actual film critic, it's probably a one or a two. But as a piece of entertainment, as a piece of 1980s art, I don't think there's ever been anything better, and I'm going to give it 10 out of 10. So I'm okay. not budging on my score. It's a 10. But I want to measure that by saying it's obviously a 1.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah. So over to you for your controversial opinion. You gave it 8 from Foresight.
Yeah. Do you know what it is? I feel like everything that I could have said, you've already said. And I think I do completely agree with the fact that it's awful. But it works in the sense that it's awful. So really, it is a 1. But, you know, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it, all the action in it and the jokes and the seriousness of it and how they thought it was serious. even like, because I know it's Queen, I know they're doing the music. Even that worked. And it wasn't, and at no point during this did I think, oh, this is a bit cringe. I don't really want to watch it. I really enjoyed it in a sort of non-sarcastic way. So I think for me, it's also a 10 out of 10. But purely based on enjoyment factor and the fact that I can't wait to rewatch it.
It is a film that you can watch over and over again and never get bored of. I think it is the ultimate cult movie, and I think it is the ultimate so bad it's good movie as well. It's a 10. It just is all day long. And the soundtrack, as you correctly point out, doesn't hurt it because it's so memorable. You know, it's so good. Even the bits that aren't the kind of major flash theme, even the battle scenes and all of that kind of stuff, it's just great. I loved it. It's a 10.
It's like I sent you that message saying I can't believe I've never seen this before. That's both a good thing and a bad thing, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Would you rewatch it?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. What would be your one word review?
I kind of wanted to say classic.
Yeah.
Is that too obvious?
No, classic is good. I was trying to think of one as well.
Perfect.
I don't know. Perfect. Yeah.
Flashy.
Flashy is good. The perfect movie. Probably something from one of the Queen songs. Miracle. There we go. Flash. He's a miracle. Is he though? Is he a miracle? Are you sure?
He's kind of just some guy.
So, yeah. He's just an American football player. Flash Gordon, New York Jets. And the bit where he's like, okay, well, I'm going to fight all of these people by pretending that it's an American football game. Like, but they've got guns, Flash. They're just going to shoot you. And that whole thing ends with him getting hit on the head. Genius. Yeah.
Good.
So, getting on to the second part of our podcast, Sam and I, as I've already referenced, had been asked the question if you could remake any movie, and I sort of forced this one upon you. So here's how I think this is going to work. Okay, so we're going to recast the movie. We're going to select a director, and we're going to talk about what that new movie would look like. So you and I, we're the producers. Okay.
Okay.
We have been given by a major studio a couple of $100 million. To spend on this movie. So question number one. Now, let's just assume, of course, that it never, ever, ever needs to be recast. It is the perfect movie.
Yeah.
But okay. We're going to remake it, okay? So if you were producing this movie, who would you suggest might be recast in the modern world as Flash Gordon? And then you tell me who you've got. I'll tell you who I've got. But eventually we have to make a decision.
Oh, okay. I like that. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. So you go first. Who have you got?
So I was originally going to do this as a joke. and say Chris Pratt because he seems to be in everything. So that was my joke guess answer originally. But what I thought while I was watching it was Chris Hemsworth, because I feel like he could fill the role quite well. But I don't know if his face quite matches the youthful joy of Flash Gordon, so maybe it would have to be Chris Pratt. So I think I'm going to meet in the middle and pull a classic Flash Gordon and have Chris Hemsworth as Flash Gordon, but Chris Pratt does the dub for the voice. That's my idea.
Genius. Okay. I have nothing else to offer. I probably would have gone for Chris Hemsworth. Uh-huh. Chris Pratt was somewhere in there. I also thought maybe Zac Efron could do it if you put a blonde wig on him, because I think he's pretty good. But we're gonna lock that in immediately, because you're absolutely right. Chris Hemsworth dubbed by Chris Pratt. Okay, that's locked in. So moving on to Dale Arden.
I struggled with this one. I didn't quite know who would fit that role quite well. And then just randomly, hopefully you've got a better one, just randomly it came to me, Rebecca Ferguson could probably do a decent job, because she's a serious actress, but in real life she's quite funny. And I feel like she could put some of the funny side into it and play it off as slightly unserious, and I think that would work. But you might have a better one.
No, I think we might be together on this. I had two people. I had a list of two or three people, okay?
Okay.
And so somewhat predictably in the modern world, I had Sydney Sweeney? Is that her name?
Ah, yeah.
So she was there. But I had on my list Aubrey Plaza.
Yeah.
And Rebecca Ferguson.
Oh, wow. Cool.
So I think, therefore, we should go with Rebecca Ferguson.
Okay, yeah, that works.
Okay, I like that. I think I probably had Amy Adams in there somewhere as well, just because Amy Adams and I like her. and I suppose I also had Linda Cardellini, but arguably a bit old maybe for that role now.
Yeah, probably, yeah.
So should we agree on Rebecca Ferguson as Dale Arden?
Let's do that, but at some point we have to agree on one of yours as well, because so far, two for two for me.
Although that was one of yours as well. I'll go first on Dr. Hans Zarkov, the mad scientist.
Okay.
Okay, so I've got a couple here. I had Jeff Goldblum, obviously. Yeah,
naturally.
Who I thought he could pull that off. I also had Steve Carell.
Okay, yeah,
might
yeah.
be quite fun in that part. Bill Nye, I thought, might be able to pull it off. I didn't really have anybody beyond that. So, because I got kind of stuck on Jeff Goldblum and thought, why would you cast anybody else?
Yeah.
But maybe you have somebody else.
This is another one I kind of struggled with, but then I think I landed quite well with Peter Capaldi, and he doesn't even have to do an American accent, because I think he could just nail that role.
Oh, you see, this is the thing where you bring that kind of additional insight, because now you've said Peter Capaldi as Dr. Hans Zarkov. I'm on board.
Okay. Can I just jump in as well? I picked someone to play Munson quite early on.
Okay.
But then realized he's not really in the film that much. And I was going to say Paul Walter Hauser, because I think he could fill that role quite well. But he's not that big in the film as a character. Yeah. So I think, maybe you haven't cast him. I don't know.
No, I hadn't. No, they're not on my list of casting, but I do love Peter Capaldi as Dr. Hans Zarkov. I can definitely see that. This is going to be the best. This is the best movie of all time.
Already.
Ever. Yeah. Already. As I was playing this game in my head, I thought, why is nobody doing this?
I know.
Why not? You know, you could cast this movie 20 times over and it would always be brilliant. So let's move on to Ming the Merciless. Your turn. You have to go first with Ming the Merciless.
I think mine's going to be really obvious, but I think this person could really suit the role in the sense that I could actually kind of see them, and that is Ben Kingsley.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's on my list too, yeah, because you could definitely see him as that. He looks a bit like him. He's the right age. I thought Idris Elba could probably pull this off. I think he would be quite a good one. Javier Bardem would also be very good, I think, as Ming the Merciless. And then I thought, what about, like, let's get all kind of postmodern. What about Cate Blanchett?
I did think, like, I should have probably gender swapped someone, yeah.
So I thought maybe Kate, you know, based on the whole Thor Ragnarok thing.
Yeah.
But again, I think your idea is better than mine. I think Ben Kingsley.
I'm leaning towards Javier Bardem.
Yeah, he would be good, wouldn't he? He has that kind of I don't know, Spanish flair, the accent.
Because he did quite well in that non-existent Pirates of the Caribbean 5 in a sort of bad guy kind of character.
Yes, he did.
In that sort of sense.
So should we go Javier Bardem?
I'm happy to, yeah.
You know, the other person I thought of was Christoph Waltz.
Ah, yeah. That could have worked,
I think he might be pretty good in this as well. I think he would bring a completely different, properly evil Ming to it.
Yeah.
But I do think that Javier Bardem is the guy that we're casting, right?
I think so, yeah.
Okay, so Javier Bardem as Ming the Merciless. My turn on Voltan, leader of the Hawkmen, which it was, of course, was famously Brian Blessed. Mm-hmm. That's a tough one, right? Because it's Brian Blessed.
Yeah. I'd thought of someone, a second option, but now I can't think of who it was because I think my first option I'm quite happy with.
I had a couple. I had some pretty obvious ones. Jason Momoa, pretty obvious. Yeah. And the guy from Dave Bastuta, is that who it is?
Was
a pretty obvious choice as well. I had thrown in Jack Black as my kind of wild card.
Okay, I can see that.
But then I just thought, no, it has to be Russell Crowe.
Yeah.
Why would it be anybody else?
True.
So what have you got?
I went for David Harbour of the Stranger Things fame.
Yeah, fair
because
enough.
Because in like Thunderbolts and Black Widow, I think he's very similar to that role, but Russian.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I could see him doing it. But I do quite like some of yours.
Yeah. No, I think David Barber is a good shout for that because he has a little bit of star presence.
Yeah.
But
I kind of want to say Jack Black, but would that ruin the music?
It's possible that it might. I still want to say Russell Crowe.
We'll go for Russell Crowe then.
Let's go Russell Crowe.
Yeah.
Let's go Russell Crowe. I think that's funny and it's camp and good, and I think it's an homage to Brian Blessed because you've cast this kind of great kind of hammy actor in it. Okay, what about our new Prince Baron? Who would that be?
My immediate thought, Matt Bomer. I'm sticking with it. Because I think he needs to be in bigger roles as well. And I think he's a decent actor and I think he could pull off this kind of character in a sort of cool, suave kind of way.
Yeah, I'm not going to disagree with you. I had Henry Cavill as my number one choice.
Fair enough. He is British. I kind of slipped on that.
He can do the British thing, but I might agree with you, and I might agree with you because I think Matt Bomer deserves a big role in a big movie because he's a really fabulous actor.
Yeah.
And by some significant degree, the most attractive human being that ever walked the earth.
Do you know he was going to be Superman at one point?
I did know that, yeah. And he would have been a brilliant Superman.
Absolutely.
So should we go Matt Bomer?
If you're happy to. I mean, that's also a bit of a Chuck thing there because Timothy Dalton and Matt Bomer were in Chuck.
That is true. That is true. But I think I agree with you. I think you could definitely... put it off. The only other person would be the actor whose name I can't remember, but famously plays Lucifer. And was in Miranda. What's his name?
Tom something, I think.
Yeah, he would be quite good. But I'm secretly rooting for him to be the next James Bond. So
that's a good choice, actually. Yeah.
Let's not cast him. Aaron Taylor Johnson could probably do it.
That's a good point. Yeah, I think he could fit that role. He's the sort of strong male type. Yeah.
So who are we going to go with?
Oh,
so many things we've talked about.
I know. I don't know. I'm leaning towards Henry Cavill. Purely because of the British part of it.
Let's go Henry Cavill as Prince Baron. Also, he could grow the moustache as well.
True. Good point. We've seen him do it.
And then and then what they could do is they could CGI it out just for a laugh throughout the entire movie.
Flip it and CGI it in.
What about Princess Aura, Ming's daughter?
This one, not Italian, but I wanted to keep the sort of accent and that sort of thing about it. I'm probably going to butcher the name. Danielle Melchior, or Melchior maybe, who was, what I know her from is Ratcatcher 2 in the Suicide Squad. And I think she could do a good job of this role as well.
Mm-hmm. I had a couple. Let me tell you who I've got. I've got Vanessa Kirby.
Okay.
I think could do that. I thought I had Anna Taylor-Joy as somebody that could possibly pull that role off. But I've already mentioned this actress, and once I had the idea, I couldn't see past it, and that would be Aubrey Plaza.
Yeah.
I couldn't see past it. She's going to bring something else to it. Perhaps not quite the ridiculous amount of inappropriateness, but that kind of dryness, that kind of, world-weary sarcasm thing that she has. And once I thought that, I couldn't see past it.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one.
So we're going to go with Aubrey Plaza.
Yeah.
That kind of rounds off, I think, the kind of main cast. At some point we're going to have to repeat all of that, and I can't remember what we've just all agreed, so so if you listen to it, do take some notes.
I was going to say, like, have you written that down?
next question then would be, who are we going to get to direct the movie? Who's the director? We're the producers. Who's our director of choice?
For me, the pick that I've got, we've already shouted out, and that's going to be Edgar Wright, because I think he knows how to do that sort of fun comic booky type thing in a movie. I'm thinking particularly of Scott Pilgrim, and I think using his ability to direct and, I don't know, have some sort of say in the edit room, I think he could really bring this movie to life.
Yeah, I think you're right. I'm going to just throw out a couple of other ideas. Let's see if you have any particular feelings on these. So I thought, okay, so I made a little shortlist here. So when I started making my shortlist, top of the list, I think because it was the most obvious, if not the best choice, I'll rephrase that. I don't think it's the best choice, but it was the most obvious, was Taika Waititi.
I knew that was coming, yeah.
And then I had Edgar Wright. And then I had Matthew Vaughn. And then I thought, well, why not just give somebody a go who can kind of do the color, the camp and everything else, but in a different way. So then I started thinking, what about Christopher Nolan or Zack Snyder, or even heaven forbid, someone like Baz Luhrmann, who did Moulin Rouge and all of those things. Yeah. I mean, what would Baz Luhrmann bring to this movie? If you said to Baz Luhrmann, here's $200 million, go away and make Flash Gordon, you might end up with something actually remarkable.
Yeah.
And then I thought, what about Sam Raimi?
True. Yeah.
So I mean, from all of that, we have to sort of choose one. And I was stuck.
I think I'm stuck too. But part of me wants to see what Baz Luhrmann could bring.
Should we go Baz Luhrmann?
Yeah. Fun fact about Baz Luhrmann. When we did Romeo and Juliet in secondary school, a friend of mine had to speak up about the bit that we'd watched, and he thought that it was Basil Ehrman. We all had a good laugh at that.
Can I just say that the Baz Luhrmann movie of Romeo and Juliet from 1996 was the greatest gift to English teachers around the world, bar none, because it's such a good movie. And, you know, like, typically boys aren't interested, but you put on the first 10 minutes of that movie and everybody's like, oh my goodness, that's the most amazing thing I've ever seen. And so whatever else happens for the next hour and 45 minutes that they're in, it was such a gift. So we're going to go Baz Luhrmann, I think. But then the other thing I would throw in would be your man Guillermo del Toro might also be quite good at this as well.
Yeah.
But I do think Baz Luhrmann has what it takes to pull off the camp and the color, but can clearly direct a movie with heart and seriousness, as evidenced by, say, for example, Moulin Rouge and Romeo and Juliet. So I'm going to go Baz Luhrmann.
I'm going to go with you. I think something that I noticed about this film, Flash Gordon from 1980, not our version, of course, a lot of it was a jar and smash cut to the next scene. Yeah. So I think Baz Luhrmann could fix that and sort of do it in his own traditional way. I think that would work, yeah.
Are we creating the greatest movie of all time ever here, by the way?
I think we are, yeah. Give us the money.
Yeah, give us... Where is the $200 million we're waiting for? Soundtrack? What would you do with the soundtrack? I have my own views. I'm fascinated by yours.
I would keep it the same. And I think it would have to be... It's like a fixed event in time. It has to be this album. Maybe change it a little bit here and there to modernize it, but I think keep it the same.
I think remastering it for Dolby Atmos, 3D sound.
Yeah.
You could, like, so imagine yourself in the cinema. You've popped off to watch Spider-Man 17 or something. And the trailers are playing. You don't know it's coming. And you hear the iconic dum 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 dum. And suddenly the film we're describing leaps onto the screen. There's no soundtrack that you could create that would ever be better than this one for the movie that we're describing.
Yeah. So
I would say the best you could do would be maybe to kind of get sort of modern artists to come in and do their own versions of these songs. So it might be quite fun to hear Muse do the Flash theme.
True.
That kind of thing. But actually, why would you change it?
Yeah, I think it should be locked in from the start.
So, and I also think as well, like, it part of the marketing of the movie could be, you know, Queen. They're still pretty popular. They're still consistently in the top 50 artists on Spotify, extraordinarily. And so I think there's a marketing thing in here, you know, Queen and Flash back for a new generation.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of thing worked for Stranger Things with, like, Kate Bush and things like that. So I think it's completely plausible, yeah.
And you can't imagine the kind of the thing kind of, you know, it would be incomprehensible to have a Flash Gordon movie without at least some reference to Flash RR. Even if it was just playing on a radio in the background somewhere, right?
Yeah. I mean, even, like, the Flash TV show had to use it because it's just iconic.
It is, absolutely. Yeah. Wow.
One thing that I think as well that I would like to just keep the same is the practical sets, props and monsters. I think...
Yes.
I mean, again, clean it up a little bit, make it look a bit more modern. But I think this film works because it's all colourful, bright and everything's real. It's like the original Star Wars things, going back to that. Scenes in Dagobah where there's like actual things coming out of the swamp, which also similarly happens in this. And I think... keep it like that. We don't need huge CGI monsters or big blue sets so that it looks the same. Just make it practical, make it colourful, make it real. And again, I think that's the same for CGI. I think it needs to be slightly cheap still. But sort of going into the satire side of things. I mean, by all means, like, perfect the CGI, make things look real. But I think then you lose the practicality of everything and the cheapness of it.
I think practical sets is a good thing, and I think Baz Luhrmann's going to give you that as well.
Yeah.
What about... So I then thought we should definitely give cameo roles to anybody that's still alive. So Sam Jones should get one. Melody Anderson should get one. They should all have a little cameo appearance in there, whatever that might be. And then I thought, is there anybody that we want to add? Is there any actor or particular character that we would just add just because we can? Is there anybody that you would just love to see in this movie if you had to invent a role for them?
Give Flash a robot sidekick. I don't know, actually, because I feel like that would take a lot of brain power to come up with a character like that. I think there's definitely a way to do it. Maybe like a fun side. Do you know what? There should be a character who follows Flash around and carries his sort of football equipment, who becomes a bit of the comic relief. Maybe not too much. I'm thinking like Kevin Hart would be quite good as the comic relief side of it. Just following him around going, oh, here's your sword, Flash, that sort of thing. But then I feel like that could be a bit great. And did you have any?
No, I didn't really have anything. I suppose the only thing I wanted to add to it was, I think there's only one actor from the entire thing that I think could play the same role. And this is just a really random shout out to Deep Roy.
Yeah.
Because he's
like
in
that.
It.
Yeah, I did see him.
I mean, and you know, he is, you know, famously in all of these movies, Willy Wonka, Lord of the Rings. There he was in Flash Gordon. So I think he should be wheeled in to play the same character, Fellini, who is the little pet of the princess. Yeah.
So this is an idea that I had the other day. I'd hope no one steals it. I'll try and be brief. Warwick Davis is coming back to play Professor Flitwick in the new Harry Potter series.
Yeah.
And I think the only way that works is if he's fully aware of it happening before. So there's a scene where he does the register and he goes down, oh, Harry Potter, hang on a minute, haven't we already had that student?
Yeah.
And the comic relief of him being there is he's fully aware of everything that's going to happen and has happened, but every time he tries to warn someone, he gets cut off. It's like the door closes, that kind of thing. Deep Roy could fill that role in this movie. And he's like, hang on a second, Flash Gordon, didn't that happen the last time? But nobody else seems to acknowledge it. So that's exactly what he should be.
The movie should be told from the point of view of Deep Roy. Yeah. In the same way, when you get to the end of the Lord of the Rings book and movie, you realize that Sam was the hero all along.
Yeah.
Deep Roy's your guy.
Behind the scenes.
I couldn't think of anybody else that you'd put in it for the sake of putting in it. I was trying to find a role for David Tennant just because I like him.
Yeah.
And, you know, there were other actors I was thinking of. Let's try and find you a role. But I think we probably nailed it.
In one of the exterior scenes, you could just have a TARDIS chilling in the background somewhere.
Well, you could definitely do all kinds of things like that. That's the kind of thing the director Taika Waititi would bring to it. All these kind of pop culture references. But sadly, we've locked in Baz Luhrmann, which I did not see coming. Did not see that coming. There you go. Okay, well, there you are. You may disagree with us, and you're welcome to do so. If you do disagree with us, you can drop us an email at thebenefitofhindsightpodcast@gmail.com. We would be fascinated to hear how you would cast this classic 1980s movie if you were given $200 million. Sam and I are going to go away and take a little break now between season 2 and season 3. But I do think we should choose the movie so people know what we're coming back to.
Yeah.
So it's your turn. What will be our season 3 opener?
So yeah, I have chosen a movie. I think it's the perfect one to go straight to after a break. The reason I've pulled up the year is because it's slightly different. Because we have to do it a slightly different way. Is it obvious yet?
No, not at all.
Okay. We're going to do it. It's Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers Special Extended Edition from 2003, okay. Apparently. Even though it came out in 2002, but this is... this is kind of confusing. Is it 2003?
I think it might be 2002/3, but obviously from memory in our history, we definitely watched this movie at the cinema, this special extended edition. So it probably was early 2003, yes.
It's just confusing because IMDb has a page for the special edition scenes. So it says 56 minutes long, 2003.
Right.
But that must just be those scenes.
Yeah.
So one of those years, yeah.
But okay, excellent. 2003 extended edition of The Two Towers. It's a good job we got a bit of a break because it goes on for about 19 hours.
So that's why I chose it.
Okay, you chose it. Let's have your score from memory.
I think, I don't know how much, well, I've got brief stories about seeing it at the cinema, because obviously it was a big thing for us to go and see this long a movie, especially when I was that young. But I do remember enjoying it, every second of it, and later rewatches, I've always appreciated Two Towers a lot more each time. So I think I'm going to go in quite strong with this one and give it a solid, I want to say 8, but I might go for a 9 out of 10. And see where we go from there, because I do enjoy this one, and it is, as a sequel to Fellowship of the Ring, it's perfect. As technically a prequel to Return of the King, also kind of perfect, but we'll see how I go from there, yeah. I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, to be brief in our extended episode, I was thinking about this the other day. I think it might be the best of the three movies.
Yeah.
And we'll come to why that is when we actually finally get to talk about it. But for me, it's a 10. A 10 out of 10. I think it's pretty close to the perfect movie. So I'm going to go with a strong 10.
Cool.
Because we don't do 11.
Well, mostly.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks very much for being with us through this extended episode. Maybe at some point we'll need to write down who we cast as all these people, but because from memory, I can't remember. But
we'll do it in the edit.
Thanks. I hope you have enjoyed our journey through Flash Gordon, I think the greatest movie of all time ever made. Do you know what day it is tomorrow?
Not tomorrow, no.
Do you know what day it is today?
Apparently, International Taekwondo Day.
Wow. Yeah. There you go. Do you celebrate?
No.
No. Tomorrow, of course, is September the 5th, which is Freddie Mercury's birthday. So it seems like a pertinent thing. So we've timestamped the episode again. But, you know, as we spent some time talking about Flash Gordon, and Freddie would have been 79.
Wow.
Tomorrow. Let's just say happy birthday, Fred.
And happy birthday. That,
if you celebrate it, which I do, obviously.
Cool.
So thanks very much for listening. We'll be back, I think, probably a couple of weeks from now with Season 3 and the Two Towers Extended Edition from 2003. Thank you so much for listening to us. I hope you've enjoyed Season 2.
If you didn't enjoy Season 2, I watched Cloverfield for nothing.
And Flash Gordon.
Well, that one was worth it.
Yeah. Bye.
Bye.
With the benefit of hindsight, we'll see, were the movies truly awful? Or did they change history?